Greetings, everybody. This is your host of the Farm Middle Podcast, Nick Deolius. We're entering the month of February. That's the most challenging month of the year for me, much of the challenge being weather-related, of course. And February 2nd is Groundhog Day. That's that strange but lovable tradition. It takes place in Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania, not too far from where I live. I don't know what Phil the Groundhog is going to do this year, you know, whether he sees his shadow or not. And I don't know what his accuracy has been historically when it comes to predicting the remainder winter, but I can tell you he's got to be more accurate than most United Nations and environmentalist organizations' climate models these days. And I'm half joking and half serious with that comment. Let's get right to our sports dedication for episode number 89. You know, I could have gone in a lot of different directions for the dedication here at 89. In the world of hockey, there's Alexander McGillney, if you remember him. And in the world of football, there's a host of worthy candidates. The more recent player that comes to mind would be Steve Smith, who was such a tough receiver. But then you've got your classic Hall of Fame players that you could have picked, such as Mike Ditka, a fellow Pittsburgh native, and Dave Robinson, a fellow Penn State alum. But there is another 89, also in the world of football, that I think best deserves this episode's dedication. He played in the 50s and 60s in the NFL, and few people today, even football fans, even know of his name. That's a shame because he was truly one of the greatest to ever play professional football. And he's also one of those individuals that has a very impressive life story off of the football field. His name, Gino Marchetti. And if you know the name, kudos. You know your football history for sure. And if you don't know the name, listen up because you need to know it. Gino Marchetti was originally born in West Virginia, but he moved at an early age to California. And right after high school, he did what a lot of the greatest generation did. He enlisted in the Army during World War II, and he saw active combat, the most notable being when he served as a machine gunner during the Battle of the Bulge in Europe. And Marchetti described his combat experience as being, I think the term he used was life-altering in an interview, and I've got no doubt about that. He was drafted in 1952 by a team that ultimately became the Baltimore Colts. He played both ways, spending seasons on the offensive line, but also really making his name on the defensive line as an end. He was dominant as a defensive player. Sid Gilman, the Hall of Fame coach, called Marchetti the greatest player in football. Forrest Gregg, a Hall of Fame offensive lineman in his own right, he singled out Marchetti as the best he ever played against. And Marchetti went through a bit of a transformation with respect to his playing style. You know, he started out as an intimidator and a bit of a cheap shot artist, and that was back in the day when cheap shots, they were way more brutal than what you see in today's cleaner playing NFL. But he matured with his playing style, and although he remained one of the hardest hitters in the league, his play sort of lost the dirty aspect, which was great. And Gino Marchetti became a successful businessman after his football playing days. He created a hamburger franchise that was called Gino's Hamburgers. And that grew to over 300 stores across the mid-Atlantic United States. Marriott ended up acquiring the company in the early 1980s, and they folded it into its Roy Rogers franchise. So if you ate at a Roy Rogers somewhere in the mid-Atlantic United States, it very well could have been originally a Gino's Hamburgers joint that you were eating at. Now, how great was Marchetti in the context of the history of the NFL? 9 straight Pro Bowls, and that was a streak that was stopped only by a broken ankle that he suffered during the championship game. And he's on the NFL 1950s All-Decade Team, the 50th Anniversary All-Time Team, the 75th Anniversary All-Time Team, and the 100th Anniversary All-Time Team. So Gino Marchetti is a player for the ages and might be the greatest player that most people never even heard of. Football player for the ages, combat veteran, successful businessman, Episode 89, proudly dedicated to Gino Marchetti. They certainly don't make them like that anymore, and that is a shame, not just for the game of football, but for our nation. And that ties into our first connection to make on Episode 89 of The Far Middle. By the way, for those of you that are new, welcome, and I hope you become what we reference here as a constant listener. And for the first-timers, note what we do on each episode is we tie a series of what appear to be unrelated thoughts together by making connections from one to the next. And we do that in honor of and to pay homage to the great BBC science series Connections and its host, Dr. James Burke. So back to making the first connection for this episode. Another thing that they don't make much of anymore, besides the Gino Marchettis of the Greatest Generation, is what used to be fairly common in the political arena of the United States, which is the political moderate. So moderate Democrat or moderate Republican, doesn't matter. Both are in rare form these days. And the dearth of moderates in the political arena today, I think, is creating massive problems and mushrooming risks for our nation. I'm so troubled by this that I took the time to write an essay on the topic that you can read in its entirety on nickdeolius.com. The title of the essay is America Needs a Third Party. So give that a read if you get a chance. But I'm certainly of the opinion, along with many of my fellow citizens, that something is seriously wrong within our nation's current fabric. But I don't believe that the remedy is drastic change. That might make only things worse when you think it through. So I'm not beating the drum to sort of eliminate the Electoral College or pack the Supreme Court or adopt a socialist model for the economy. Quite the opposite. Instead, what I think we need is to continue on our traditional course of adhering to the Constitution and respecting the individual and preserving the free market. Those things got us to be the envy of the world, and they will keep us there. But our political system is in desperate need of new blood. We've been a two-party nation for far too long, and that cartel has created quite the harmful dynamic today. It used to be that each party was sort of a variation or a slight variation of the other one, but the ideals that each promoted were shared or common, or at worst, they were similar. But today, you know, the two parties have split into separate orbits of extremes that cater to the small but the influential fringes, while the big middle, the far middle, dare I say, is largely left unrepresented and unheard. That's not good. And I think the root cause of the extreme fringes now ruling each party, it can be traced to the primary in an election cycle. Primaries increasingly are killing off the moderate candidates in the campaign crib before they can make it to the general election. And all too often, from sea to shining sea, a moderate Democrat gets obliterated by an outright leftist in the primary, and a moderate Republican gets bludgeoned by a far-right candidate in a Republican primary. And each opposing party loves this dynamic when it occurs with the other party, to the point where one party funds the extreme candidate from the other party during the primary. Strategy, of course, is hoping that the extreme candidate prevails in a primary so that the chances for the opposing party for a win in the general election goes up or is higher. A serious problem with this dynamic is that very talented moderate candidates, they take a look at the reality of the primary process and they decide to not even consider running for office. I summed it up in the essay on the website by saying that one used to have to be nuts to run for office, but today, to successfully run, you increasingly need to be nuts and extreme in ideology. And this dynamic of election reality today under the two-party cartel, it's got serious consequences for the moderate voter. So if you're going to vote and you're a moderate, you end up with one of two choices to make at the ballot box. You can vote for the leftist, whose policies you probably take some issues with, but at the same time, being a leftist, the candidate is offering up free stuff. And it's likely that a lot of the free stuff might be going to benefit you, at least perceptually. So it might be something like an electric vehicle subsidy and a tax break for the affluent suburbanite. Or it might be student debt forgiveness for the young college grad. Or it could be something like universal income. But when Santa Claus is running for office by offering up free stuff and gifts to everyone, the candidate might be tough to beat. And that's particularly true when the opposition is coming from the right. And that's because too many Republican candidates in elections these days, they embody their own brand of suppressing individual rights. And we talked about, I think in a prior episode of The Far Middle, the Anti-Woke Act in Florida, which to me is a clear suppression of free speech coming from the right. But there are other examples far too common. Same outcome of suppression of the individual, just a different brand under one of the two cartels. So the moderate voter basically got two options on election day, when election day shows up, right? One would be the leftist, as we discussed, whose views disturb, but who's offering the voter all that stuff. And the other option is basically embodying extreme views from the right that frightens a voter and doesn't offer up any free stuff. By then, the exhausted moderate often ends up voting for the former, or in many instances might not even show up at the ballot box at all. So what's the solution? I think it's pretty simple. What we need today is a third national political party. And that's a party who has a platform where the Constitution is respected, individual rights reign supreme, the free market is left to do its thing, fiscal discipline is exercised, and government is set at a minimal level to provide just the bare minimum of necessary responsibilities. That's not today's Democratic Party, and that's not today's Republican Party. What it would be called would be libertarian. And there are two classic strains of libertarianism. The first is the purer and also the more extreme of the two. It's sort of what the great Ayn Rand subscribed to. It's based on the view that all government intervention is some form of coercion. And when you coerce the individual, that's immoral. And thus governments tend to be immoral. Now, this view of libertarianism would say that government should be minimized to the point where it's almost eliminated, and the government should not prevent individual choice, even if that individual choice might infringe on the rights of others. So I'm a big fan of Ayn Rand's, as you know, and her works, but this isn't my preferred brand of libertarianism. No, instead, I subscribe to the second strain and the more practical strain of libertarianism, which is the Milton Friedman view. Government should still be minimized to maximize freedom of the individual, but government is also there to protect the ability of other individuals to do the same for themselves. So here, individual choice remains paramount, but it shouldn't infringe on the rights of others to follow their own values. The Milton Friedman approach to libertarianism, I think, would be viewed favorably by many moderate voters in America today. It's a winning formula steeped in the traditions and values that are America. Government out of the classrooms and out of our bedrooms, the state spending only what it takes in, shrinking the administrative state, letting the free market loose, and adhering to the Constitution and respecting individual rights. Not just good stuff, but great stuff. And by the way, what are those bare minimum things that government should exist to provide? Well, national defense is a big one. So is protecting the rule of law and property rights. And of course, protecting the minority view and thus individual rights. If government would stick to these bare necessities or essentials, taxpayers would actually realize a decent rate of return on their investment. And I'd consider this introduction of a third political party that embraces libertarianism in a practical sense, not a break from Western Republican democracy tenets, but instead a restatement of them, or a reaffirmation, so to speak. The middle, which really doesn't have a voice today, would become quite relevant once again. I think you'd see actually a moderation of Democratic and Republican parties as well, as they inevitably would desire to move toward the middle because of this, and that would impact the primaries, which, as we discussed, is currently a root cause of why the middle doesn't have much of a voice these days. And a lot of what ails our current political environment and that bothers me really can be traced back to an analogy in the business world. Cartels that control markets, they're never good for consumers. So if you've only got two products to choose from, whether they be colleges or soft drinks or cars or news outlets, the cartel gets to control all the decision-making and it holds all the cards. There's little incentive to evolve in a positive way, right? Or to continually improve or to serve the customer. If suddenly you had a third product that was introduced into the cartel-controlled market, and that product offered up a good experience for consumers, it would be an instant success, and it would inevitably lead the two more entrenched products to either improve and evolve, or in the end to die. The same dynamic would apply in politics with respect to the introduction of a third party that embraced libertarianism. Our political system created a vacuum through a two-party cartel for far too long. Let's break that cartel and create more choice for voters. As we've mentioned this a few times in the past on the Far Middle, President Biden, he made the comment that Milton Friedman isn't running the show anymore. That's true. And at the same time, that's sad. And it's true whether Republicans or Democrats are in power. I'm not a politician, and I don't desire to be one, but I do want to be able to choose from the very best of options when it comes to selecting our political leaders. That's what the Founding Fathers envisioned, and I think that's what America deserves. Yeah, that was fun, investing a couple of minutes covering, I think, an interesting and pertinent topic. And as I said, you know, if you want to read more about it, jump on the nickdeolius.com website. You'll find it under the Topics tab. So if you're somebody of the libertarian persuasion and you've got an interest in politics or running for office, call 1-800, you know, or log on to www. But seriously, constant listeners, we do need candidates of a libertarian mindset to start running for office sooner rather than later. I really believe that. And if you question why I think libertarianism would play well to the middle, I offer up as evidence for our next connection as to what's going on in states where the extremes rule, particularly the far left. I saw some census data recently that listed the states and how they rank when it comes to net domestic population migration from the summer of 2021 to the summer of 2022, so over the course of a year. And the results were pretty compelling, I think very interesting. The five states that suffered the worst net negative domestic population migration over that period of time, they were California. It did the worst. It was at the very bottom, followed by New York, then Illinois, New Jersey, and finally Massachusetts. So those were the five states that lost the most residents over that period of time. And when you look at those states of California, New York, Illinois, New Jersey, and Massachusetts, you don't have to be a political genius to correlate those states to being governed by some of the most extreme and leftist leaders that you're going to find in the Democratic Party. It's beyond a coincidence the residents are rushing to the exits and to the borders of those states to escape them to find something more normal and more moderate. So we know with the extreme left and with the extreme side of the Democratic Party, there is a repulsion by many Americans and a desire for something more moderate. And I suspect the same can be said for the extreme right and with the extreme side of the Republican Party. The data show increasingly it's something like libertarianism that will please the moderate and the middle, and it's something that's desperately needed. Looking at those five states, ones like California and New York, brings me to the next connection and dot to connect to. A lot of those states, if not all five of them, along with the left, they adhere to a strict brand of environmentalism and climate change ideology. And thus, many of these states, they mandate and they subsidize and they protect electric vehicles as a way to, and you know, here's the air quotes again, tackle climate change. And many on the left in the United States, they take their cue and they dutifully follow the left in Europe. It's almost as if the EU is serving as a mentor to leftists in the United States. Now, why we would want to follow that model, considering the mess that Europe is in these days, beats me. But I'll give you another example of exactly what I'm talking about. You see, over this winter, rocketing electricity prices in Europe, they've drastically increased the cost of driving electric vehicles in Europe. And in some instances, it's more expensive to run an electric vehicle because of the electricity needed to charge it than it is to run a gas-powered vehicle, believe it or not. Now, if you think that is not going to get the attention of consumers and have a negative impact on the desired transition that the government has to an electric transportation fleet, think again. And it's a pretty simple dynamic. Electricity prices, they've gone way up in part because of climate change policies, which then enabled Putin to invade Ukraine, which then built up an already brewing energy crisis. And that means in some cases, there is no longer a cost advantage that electric vehicles enjoy over gasoline-powered vehicles. In fact, depending on the situation and the timing, electric vehicles have become more expensive to fuel than the gasoline-powered alternatives. And when you put on top of this that certain governments in Europe are considering removing subsidies that the buyers of electric vehicles are enjoying, it's going to make an even more difficult situation for the transition to electric vehicles to occur on the desired timelines and what it was facing going into this mess. And I saw some math to put this in perspective. In Germany, Tesla increased its price for superchargers a couple of times in 2022, up to over 70 cents per kilowatt hour back in the fall of 2022. Now that price, which granted is at the higher end, Tesla's Model 3, which is the most efficient of electric vehicles according to the EPA, it would cost almost $20 to charge for a 100-mile drive. And by point of comparison, someone driving a gasoline vehicle in Germany would be paying slightly lower than what it costs to charge that Tesla for the 100-mile drive. Now, what's happened is pretty basic. Climate change policies have increased the cost of all forms of energy, including and most notably electricity. Electricity, that's the fuel for electric vehicles. If electricity increased in price more than gasoline or oil increased in price, then at some point it's going to be more expensive to fuel and operate an electric vehicle compared to a gasoline-powered vehicle, which, by the way, is the exact opposite of what the proponents of climate change policies and electric vehicle subsidies and those tackling climate change, the exact opposite of what they warranted from the beginning. Another false promise made by the environmental movement and another failure to deliver. But you don't read much about this or hear as much about it as you should across the mainstream media, because that's an institution that's hopelessly conflicted when it comes to climate policy. Today, the media is much more interested in serving as an advocate and a promoter of climate change policies than it is interested in being an objective reporter of the facts and of the reality. The topic of the energy crisis and the cost of energy and the state of the overall inflation in Europe, those things bring us to our next connection. European governments, they're in the process of, or they're preparing to, flood the market with new bonds and debt issuances. So governments in Europe are levering up, and that's saying something because these are some of the most indebted governments that you're going to find on the planet. And why are they doing this? Like, why are they borrowing more? Because governments in Europe are spending enormous amounts of money trying to shield their economies and their consumers from what? From the high costs of energy. Now, this is occurring at a really bad time for European governments. First, because, as I just said, debt levels of nations are already quite high across the continent. Second, the cost of debt is going up because central banks all over the world, including the ECB, they're raising interest rates rapidly. So debt's growing and it's becoming more expensive. And both of these things are happening at exactly the worst possible time, which is the third problem. And that, of course, is that Europe is in the grips of a recession, largely brought on by the energy crisis, which was traced back to climate policies. Now, here's the irony. The EU started this entire mess by passing climate policies that mandated the restriction of energy supply and a reliance on things like unreliable wind and solar at scale, and then the subsidization of electric vehicles. These all lead to some very foreseeable consequences, which were energy scarcity and energy inflation and general inflation and grid stress and an emboldened Russia in a situation where electric vehicles become prohibitively expensive to operate when compared to gasoline-powered vehicles. Consumers get crushed, businesses end up going bankrupt, and the economy teeters or tanks into recession, which then creates a desire for governments to shield consumers from the inevitable consequences of government's own policies, which, by the way, are the exact opposite consequences the government promised when shoving these policies down the throats of its citizens. So now governments, they borrow more money on top of the money they borrowed to tackle climate change to now shield consumers from the consequences of tackling climate change. That's government in a nutshell. Manufacture an epic crisis in the need to tackle climate change, use that crisis to justify far-reaching climate policies, watch the inevitable consequences take root, including inflation and recession, have your citizens feel the pain and suffer, then come to the half-hearted rescue by offering them payments and protection from inflation, the very thing your policy created. The one constant throughout this entire journey, of course, is continuing to spend more than government takes in and the constant borrowing of debt. Where does it end? We shall see, but I fear the answer, and so should you. Yes, to quote the great Bob Dylan, the times they are a-changin'. And looking at the time, it's about that time to close down episode 89. Now, that album by Bob Dylan, The Times They Are Changing, that was released about this time of year back in 1964. And you constant listeners know that I'm a bit of a Bob Dylan fan. I see that he has a new book out that discusses the subject of songwriting, and I do plan on giving it a read, although I haven't yet. But I did read an interview that Bob Dylan gave during the promotion of the book release that just came out recently. And the interviewer was asking Bob Dylan about how he fared during the lockdown. And I thought his answer was insightful, and I thought it tied to government typically being the problem and not the solution. So I wanted to share with you what he said. Now remember, when pandemic first hit, governments, including our own federal and many state governments, they took some seriously draconian action, and they saw an opportunity to exert more control by instituting lockdowns across the economy and society. In hindsight, they were very damaging actions, to say the least. When asked about the lockdown, Bob Dylan admitted it was surrealistic for him, so it was a bit strange. But then he went on to mention all the ways it was beneficial to him. He said it was good not having a clock to worry about, and he worked on restoring his 56 Chevy. He did landscape paintings. He wrote a song. He listened to Peggy Lee and Frank Zappa records. He read The Rime of the Ancient Mariner a few times. And then he said if there had been any drugs laying around, he might have just given them a try too. Now, for those of you that know Bob Dylan, this is classic Bob Dylan, if you followed him through the years. But it got me thinking about how the success of our economy and our society, it hinges on individuals and achievers and doers performing in the exact opposite way that Bob Dylan did during lockdown. In other words, artists and poets and musicians, they are the residual benefit or result of achievers who are enduring in a free market and doing in a free market where individual rights reign supreme. And a lockdown is not a strategy for societal or economic success. If you don't have the doers and achievers in a free market, then you're not going to have the Bob Dylans and no set of activities that he so enjoyed during lockdown. Or maybe said differently, if we all took the Bob Dylan lockdown approach, the world is going to come to a painful and grinding halt for everybody. Government actions that aim to take us there, they're not the path forward. And the sooner that we, including Bob Dylan, realize that, the better. That's all for this week. I will talk to you soon in 7 short days with an exciting episode 90 of The Far Middle. Peace.